The BBC is next.
Saul Kahn and Adam Leshinsky explore what happens when the AI revolution comes for education on an all-new Commonwealth Club program Thursday at 10 p.m. on KQED.
The Bay Area Raised host Erica Cruz Guevara discusses local news with journalists, providing context and analysis you need to understand the headlines. Catch new episodes of The Bay on Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays on the KQED app or wherever you get your podcasts. The heat advisory will continue tomorrow. Lows tonight will be in the lower 60s inland. The National Weather Service says Thursday highs will range from 64 at Ocean Beach to 95 in Santa Rosa for the Bay region. The southern Sacramento Valley will have Thursday highs between 95 and 104 degrees. I'm Michelle Hennigan. Michael State is here to keep you company for the rest of the night. Thank you for listening to member-supported KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highlands, Sacramento. We're live online at kqed.org. It's 11 p.m.
Hello and welcome to Newsday on the BBC World Service with Victoria Wanhunda and James Copnell. Great to have you with us.
Our main story this morning is an alleged massacre in central Sudan by the Rapid Support Forces rebels, which has killed many civilians. We'll go live to a leading human rights activist.
We're going to head to India too, where Narendra Modi will become Prime Minister for a third time, but he will have to head a coalition government. We'll talk to a representative of his party and also hear from the opposition Congress party.
And in football news, we will look at how Wolves is set to lose a bid to scrap the video assistance referee, or VAR, in the English Premier League.
In our business news, more good news for those companies fueling the AI technology revolution.
All that and so much more, but first, the latest BBC World News.
Hello, I'm Moira Alderson with the BBC News. Israel's military has struck what it said was a Hamas compound inside a UN school in central Gaza. Local journalists told the BBC that more than 20 people were killed in the attack in the Zeirat. From Jerusalem, here's Yolande Nell.
Israel's military said it had conducted a precise strike on a Hamas compound embedded inside the UNRWA school in the urban Nusayrat refugee camp. It said Hamas and Islamic Jihad forces who took part in the deadly 7th of October attacks on southern Israel had been operating at the site, and that as it targeted them, it took extensive precautions to reduce harm to civilians. The Hamas-run government's media office in Gaza accused Israel of carrying out a horrific massacre.
Polls have opened in the Netherlands, the first country to vote in continent-wide elections for the European Parliament. Around 370 million people in 27 countries will elect 720 representatives. Far-right parties look set to make large gains in a potentially seismic shift for the European Union. Myanmar's opposition and local residents have accused the army of killing at least 50 people who'd been detained in the village of Bwe Pu, close to Sitwe, the capital of Rakhine State. The soldiers had been searching for supporters of the Arakan army. Here's Jonathan Head.
The men were blindfolded and repeatedly beaten. The women were forced to keep their heads down, but say they heard multiple gunshots and later saw bodies in the streets. Some women were reportedly raped. Dozens of men were taken away to military bases. Many have not returned. The village is still being held by the military, with no one allowed to return there. There are reports that much of it has been burnt down. The ruling military council has denied the accusations.
World leaders, including the US President Joe Biden, are in Western France for the climax of 3 days of ceremonies, marking the 80th anniversary of the Normandy D-Day landings. The day started with the bagpipes being played on the beaches of Normandy. Honoured guests will be the surviving World War II veterans of the mass beach assault that marked the beginning of the campaign to drive Nazi forces from Western Europe. Joe Winwood explains the magnitude of the operation.
This was the biggest amphibious landing, the biggest amphibious assault in human history. Hundreds of thousands of men storming the beaches of Normandy, but it's also the preparation involved. The fact that not only did they have to prepare this event, they had to do it in secret, and in fact set up decoy events further along the coast, meaning that the Germans had prepared the defences in the wrong place. And so it wasn't just about the courage of the men storming the beaches that led to the success of this, but also the subtlety of the planners and, of course, the people in the planes, the Air Force, the Navy, that led the combined arms assault that led to this astonishing operation.
BBC News. The International Energy Agency says it expects global investment in renewable energy to reach twice the amount going to fossil fuels this year. A report said improving supply chains and lower costs were driving the switch to clean energy, but it warned that spending on oil and gas was still too high to meet climate goals. The Russian authorities say Ukrainian drones hit a major oil refinery in the southwest of the country, setting it on fire. The governor of the Rostov region said the attack on the Novoshakhtinsk plant had forced a suspension of work as personnel had to be withdrawn to a safe distance. The mother of a British teenager who ended his life after becoming the victim of a sextortion gang says the tech giant Meta has failed to hand over data which might help the investigation into his death. Murray Dowie, who was 16, had been tricked into sending compromising photos to criminals posing as a girl on Instagram. Meta says it is cooperating fully with the investigation. Tourism officials in China's Henan province have been forced to acknowledge that the country's proclaimed highest uninterrupted waterfall was being helped by water pipes built into the rock face. Laura Bicker reports from the Yuntai Falls.
Millions of visitors travel to Yuntai Falls in Hunan province every year to marvel at geological formations dating back more than a billion years. But as tourists took snapshots of what they've been told is China's tallest uninterrupted waterfall, one hiker took a closer look at the source. They found water gushing from a network of man-made pipes hidden in the rocks. In a statement, tourism officials admitted that small enhancements were made to the falls during dry season to make visitors feel that their trip had been worthwhile, and added in wet season, tourists can see its magnificence in a natural manner.
BBC News.
Thank you very much for that news. Hello there and welcome to Newsday on the BBC World Service with James Copnell and Victoria Wahunda. Thank you so very much for your company. This coming half hour, Sudan and the reported killings by the rebel group, the RSF, of hundreds of civilians in central Sudan. We have two voices from India, one a supporter of Narendra Modi and another from the other side of the political aisle in opposition. If you have a comment or a thought, even a question on these top stories, send them our way. We'd love to hear from you on WhatsApp and text. Our number is +447 786 205085. We have business and sport too, so do stay with us if you can.
We start in Sudan with accusations that the paramilitary rapid support forces have carried out a new massacre of civilians. The RSF has been fighting against the National Army since April last year, a war that is causing huge devastation, forcing millions to flee and, as we've been hearing all this week, plunging the country towards famine. The latest attack took place in Al Jazeera State. It's an agricultural area to the south of the capital, Khartoum. Footage on social media allegedly shows RSF militants besieging and firing on the village of Wad al-Nura. Other videos also show people standing in front of dozens of bodies covered in shrouds, ready for burial. Some reports suggest as many as 150 people may have been killed. Wahala Al-Karib is a leading Sudanese human rights activist who runs the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa, or SIHA, and joins us now. Hello, welcome back to the program. What do we know about this attack in Wad al-Nura?
Good morning, James and listener. So what's happening in Wad al-Nura, it's not unique to what has been happening in Jazeera since December 19. The RSF has been systematically attacking small villages, small farming communities across the Jazeera states. The Jazeera is one of the most populous regions of Sudan. There is, you know, over 5 million people living in that part of the country. Most of them are farming community. But what's different you know, that happen in Wadi Nura. Usually the RSF attacks, you know, with small machine guns and force themselves into people's homes. This time, the militiamen, they attack the village with heavy artillery. So imagine attacking, you know, a farming community, villages with heavy artillery, you know, and this has led to this massive massacre. And that's basically happening because, first of all, you know, they have not been a lot of emphasis or highlighting of the atrocities that's happening in Al Jazeera. It's completely a forgotten case. The current political narrative in Sudan is minimizing these massive atrocities that's happening against civilian into a political crisis. And I'm speaking particularly about, you know, the political narrative of the international community, while things are really out of hand at this point in time. You know, it's a campaign of atrocities. Civilians are quite exposed, and add to that, you know, the intentional supports that's ongoing from the United Arab Emirates, you know, to the militia as well, is further emboldening them. And they have a very strong sense that they can do whatever they want.
What would be the motivation, do you think, for attacking a village?
So it's a several layers. What's happening in Al Jazeera is an exact replicant of what happened in Darfur, you know, in 2004, 2005, and all through the past 20 years, you know, the attack that has been happening in rural Darfur. You know, it's dispossessions and forced evictions of the local populations. It's looting and control. But on the other hand, as it's proven over and again, and for the past 20 years, the RSF does not have a capacity, you know, to hold to govern, you know, any of the units that they are, you know, taking over or they are invading. So basically, it's a sequence of violence and atrocities that keeps recycling and happening, you know, and extortion of money, extortion of resources, and this is basically what it is. As of the motivations of the United Arab Emirates, were not quite clear, you know. It's quite puzzling, you know, what they are doing at the moment in terms of providing unlimited support, you know, and be part of this, you know, atrocities and killings and genocides that's happening in Sudan.
Do you see an easy solution, a relatively attainable solution to at least reducing the violence in Al Jazeera and elsewhere in Sudan right now?
I think, you know, the level of polarization is very, very high. I think, you know, we can't resolve this current crisis unless, you know, Sudanese people in their diversity, and I'm talking particularly, you know, about the FFC and the NCP, who are, you know, kind of manipulating the political narrative around SAF and the RSF, you know, accepted that they are part of the, you know, of the civilians, they are part of the political blocks, but there is millions of Sudanese who had their views about how their country should be run and should be governed, you know, and they have to accept that, you know. So at this point in time, you know, we have, you know, two political blocks that are, you know, kind of hiding behind, you know, two armed groups, you know, the NCB mostly affiliated to Sudan Armed Forces, FFC to a large extent have strong connections to the RSF, particularly following the agreements that was signed last year or early this year, and also their connections to the UAE.
Hala Al-Karib there, talking about the leading civilian movements and their connection to the warring parties in Sudan and those widespread accusations that United Arab Emirates are supporting the paramilitary rapid support forces, accusations that the RSF have denied.
Well, let's head to India, where Narendra Modi is said to be the country's prime minister for a third time, a day after humbling election results, which saw his majority slashed by a resurgent opposition. Mr. Modi was backed to be prime minister again following a meeting with his National Democratic Alliance, the NDA, on Wednesday. Mr. Modi found himself unexpectedly reliant on the NDA's smaller parties to reach a parliamentary majority after his own party fell short of the 272 seats needed to form the next government. However, the opposition, which won 232 to the NDA's 293, has yet to formally concede. Narendra Taneja is a former national spokesperson for the BJP, which is Mr. Modi's party, and he's joining us now from the capital, Delhi. A very good morning to you and welcome to the program. We had on a guest earlier today that was talking about that India saw a heat wave during this election, but however, it was not the wave that the BJP and Mr. Modi had hoped for. Where do you think you all went not so well for Modi and the BJP and those 400 seats that they had campaigned on?
Well, 400 seat was the kind of target, the agenda. And if you look at how, you know, political culture functions in India, it's important to give high targets, or rather higher targets, to your workers across the country. So the NDA gave the target of 400 seats, and the opposition Congress-led alliance called India, they gave the target of 300 seats. So, and they didn't get there, and NDA also didn't get there. So, but that's politics. I mean, you have to kind of set higher targets. But if you look at the reality now, the fact is that, you know, BJP, is there going to be a BJP-led government of National Democratic Alliance, NDA, and Prime Minister Modi will be sworn in again for the third time. So which means that, you know, most alliance partners, almost all of them, they subscribe to the same ideology, the same philosophy, same the economic direction, and the same direction as far as India is concerned in terms of its ambition to be a developed country by 2047. So I think things are more or less on the track. Yes, this time there is a little change in the sense that this is not entirely BJP government, but this is a more kind of coalition government. But this is nothing new for BJP or for India. You know, BJP had led a coalition government from 1999 to 2004 before, very successfully. So they know how to function in a coalition situation. And so this time, I don't think there are going to be any challenge. There have been discussions. They are known partners. It's not they're unknown. They have worked together with BJP before. And don't forget one thing, in the alliance, in any political alliance, you need a kind of critical mass that's the main party that can hold the alliance together. And in this case, is the BJP with very significant strength within the coalition.
So let's look at what might be the lessons that the BJP and Mr. Modi can take forward. Because in 2019, the party and Mr. Modi won with 303 seats. This time they've gone down 63, which has come at the cost of this resurgence in the opposition. What is going to be the BJP's way forward to make sure that they regain those seats and even more in the future?
Well, of course, you know, first thing is that one goes for a very scientific introspection and analysis, you know, like the constituencies where the BJP lost. So they're going to be study of each and every constituency in the most scientific manner and in a more unsentimental way in order to reach to the right conclusion. And the work will start on those constituencies for the next election, that's 2029. So BJP thinks long term. Now the immediate target is, of course, to form the government and to make sure that, you know, the country continue to progress, countries kind of working together, the alliance partners are working together, and to push through whatever reforms are needed, whatever the changes are needed, what are the promises that had been made in the manifesto. And the Prime Minister already indicated of all that. At the same time, at the party level, though, to do whatever necessary, especially in the areas and constituency where BJP had not done well or had lost election, in so that to make sure that, you know, 2029, yeah, the party is there with full majority. BJP mm-hmm. always thinks very, very long term and works in a very structured manner to get there.
All right, Narendra Taneja, thank you for your time, a former national spokesperson for the BJP.
Well, the verdict of the urns in India marks perhaps a surprising revival for the Congress Party-led India Opposition Alliance, defying earlier predictions of its decline and sharply diverging from both exit polls and pre-election surveys. Shobha Oza is a senior Congress leader, and she joins us from Madhya Pradesh in central India. Welcome to the programme. The opposition, the India Opposition Alliance, met yesterday to decide the next steps. Have you finally conceded defeat?
See, India Alliance is keeping all options open. We are going to wait and watch as to how the NDA Alliance goes ahead with the government-forming exercise. As far as the results are concerned, the masses have clearly denied its support to BJP. The BJP, which could get a clear majority in the last elections, today stands at 240, which is way behind the 272 magic number which is needed to form the government. So it is the people of India have totally shown through their votes that they do not want a BJP government.
But the BJP-led coalition clearly has enough seats to form that government, doesn't it?
Yes, that's what. Yeah, I'm coming to that. But at the same time, the NDA has 293, which gives it the authority to form the government. So let's wait and watch and see how the NDA goes ahead with the formation of the government. As far as we are concerned, we stick to our issues. We had gone to the masses with the issues which are concerned them, whether it be poverty, whether it be unemployment, whether it be the farmers' issues, the youth, the women. So we will stand with that and we will work towards the fulfillment of whatever we had promised. We will fight for it. But people, the masses are really happy that the narrative which was set by the BJP or Mr. Modi to show as if the entire country is going or happy with the working of Mr. Modi, the country has shown that it is not the case.
But you say that. I have to confess, I'm a little confused here, though, because you accept that Mr. Modi's coalition has got a majority, and yet you won't concede. I mean, why not?
See, Mr. Modi, last 10 years of Mr. Modi or his government did not mention anywhere the coalition. The coalition was there, but it was only Modi, 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 the Modi government, the manifesto of Mr. Modi, the guarantee of Mr. Modi. Nowhere did the coalition come into mention.
They're mentioning BJP it now. They've got the votes. Why not just say, we did pretty well, not quite well enough. Congratulations, Mr. Modi, and we'll be back in a few years' time.
People have denied Mr. Modi. One should understand that it is Mr. Modi has not won this election this year. He just got 240 seats, which are way behind the 272 mark, which he needed to reach, wherein he had claimed that they will get 400 seats in this election or 300 plus seats in this elections. And despite the misuse of all institutions, whether it be the income tax, whether it be the CBI, whether it be the courts, whether it be the press, everything, and Manipa, Masilpa, everything, they could just manage 240. That shows that people of India have shown Mr. Modi that this will not work in this country. It is the alliance now he's talking about. Have you heard him mention NDA in last 10 years? The alliance? No. Because he had numbers, he was like, the alliance didn't matter. It was only him.
But it is going to matter now. It will presumably see Mr. Modi sworn in again as Prime Minister. So what do you intend to do now, you and the Congress party?
See, we have to wait and watch for next 2 days.
You really think because it's possible that he won't be able to form a government?
Because now, tomorrow, there is a parliamentary meeting of the Bharatiya Janata Party. The party has to elect him first. And there's much, much going inside the party. The RSS and everyone like. Because it is the RSS which is their mother organization which works for the BJP in the elections and ensures that they win. And this time, the BJP national president in the middle of the election said that we don't need RSS. So there is a lot of wrestling going within the party. So they have to have a parliamentary board and elect Mr. Modi first from the BJP. And then the alliance partners come into action. But it is the reverse they are taking. They have already met with the alliance partners. And now tomorrow they're going to have the parliamentary committee meeting. And let's see what happens.
Okay.
Does so the RSS support him?
You're watching and waiting. Shobha Oza, thank you very much indeed. Senior leader from the Congress Party in India.
Well, let's go to business in Singapore at our desk there with Nick Marsh. And we're talking about more chips, not as in the things we eat, but, you know, the things that we need in all our laptops and phones. Because earlier you told us about NVIDIA and their record $3 trillion valuation, but another chip maker is hitting records too, right, Nick?
Yeah, that's right. Two different kinds of chips, both vital in their own way, I would argue, Vic. But yeah, NVIDIA has been doing very, very well. TSMC, the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, is also doing incredibly well today. And that's because NVIDIA's success has given them a boost, basically. The thing you need to remember is that NVIDIA might design these super advanced chips, but someone else needs to physically make them. And that someone else is TSMC, the world's biggest chip maker. They're contract manufacturers based in Taiwan. Their shares hit a record high this morning in Taipei, because if NVIDIA is doing well, then, you know, TSMC is going to be doing well, because they've got many more chips to be making and their orders keep growing and growing. Their valuation isn't quite the $3 trillion of NVIDIA, but it is kind of getting close to the trillion mark, which I guess, well, that'll do for them.
Quite very briefly, Nick, is there a danger that this bubble could burst?
Well, if you ask NVIDIA or OpenAI, you know, the AI people, they'll say, no, 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 it's going to keep growing and growing and growing because the demand was going to keep going up and we need these chips for all these things that we're going to be doing in the future. TSMC, they need to be a bit more cautious because they need to invest billions and billions and years and years and years to make the facilities that actually make these chips. So they need to think very carefully about how valuable and expensive and how much this industry is going to actually grow in the future.
Absolutely wonderful. Nick Marsh there, our business correspondent in Singapore.
Now, we've had a message into Newsday from Elias in Kampala, Uganda, who says, good morning, Newsday. Looks like the crane is flying again. Cricket crane, oye! Roger Fannin, you're here to explain from our sports desk.
Yeah, I'm glad you made that sound at the end. I thought you might skip that out. Uganda have won their first ever match at a T20 Cricket World Cup as they beat Papua New Guinea by 3 wickets. Following on from one of the worst losses in the tournament's history, a 125-run defeat to Afghanistan on Tuesday, the Cricket Cranes have bounced back as they successfully chased Papua New Guinea's total of 77 with 3 wickets and 10 balls remaining. An extraordinary win for them. It looks as though we are still going to have VAR in the Premier League next season. Clubs are meeting Thursday to discuss Wolves' motion to get rid of the video assistant referee. It's thought that Man City, Arsenal and Tottenham are among the clubs who want to keep VAR, but they are demanding that improvements are made. The Premier League says that without VAR, there would be more than 100 more incorrect refereeing decisions per season. Wolves had a pretty tough time with VAR VAR this season. It is semi-final day at the French Open Tennis. World number one Iga Swiatek takes on Coco Gauff. And 17-year-old Mira Andreeva plays Italy's Jasmine Paolina. And we're going to talk basketball later on in the programme and look at Game 1 of the NBA Finals later as the Boston Celtics take on the Dallas Mavericks on Thursday night. The Celtics looking to win title number 18.
So to sum up from my perspective, you go into cricket cranes, oye, VAR, not oye for me. Coco Gauff, oye, and I'm going to say Dallas Mavericks, oye.
Okay, let's see whether that happens. That is a pretty good and strong prediction.
And summary too, but he got to say oye so many times.
Isaac Fannin, oye.
This is Newsday.
Distribution of the BBC World Service in the U.S. is made possible by American Public Media, producer and distributor of award-winning public radio content. APM, American Public Media, with support from Babbel for Business. With over 13,000 hours of language courses, Babbel is helping businesses break down language barriers and improve workplace safety. Learn more at babbelforbusiness.com.
Support for KQED comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and their bedding at sleepworks.com. Just tap and tune in. Live news is always ready on the KQED app, your source for reliable reporting. You're enjoying the BBC World Service on a Wednesday evening. Michael State, KQED Public Radio time is 11:30. Good evening.
Hello, welcome to Newsday from the BBC World Service with Victoria Wunhunda and James Copnell.
As famine looms in Sudan, we hear from one man whose soup kitchen is facing challenges.
An Israeli strike said to be targeting Hamas has hit a UN school packed with displaced families in Gaza.
In Rwanda, Diane Rwigara tells us why she wants to run for presidency against the long-term leader Paul Kagame. But first, this news.
BBC News with Moira Alderson. An Israeli strike said to be targeting Hamas has hit a UN school packed with displaced families in Gaza, reportedly killing more than 20 people. Israel insisted it took steps to avoid harming civilians. The first votes are being cast in the European parliamentary elections. The Netherlands is the first country to open up the polls. In the coming days, 370 million people in 27 countries will be eligible to cast ballots. Myanmar's opposition and local residents have accused the army of killing at least 50 people who'd been detained in a village close to Sitwe, the capital of Rakhine State. The soldiers had been searching for insurgents. World leaders, including the US President Joe Biden, are in Western France for the climax of 3 days of ceremonies, marking the 80th anniversary of the Normandy D-Day landings. The most honoured guests will be the surviving World War II veterans. The Russian authorities say Ukrainian drones hit a major oil refinery in the southwest of the country, setting it on fire. Sudan's military government has called on the international community to condemn the mass killing of at least 150 people in a central village. It said the RSF paramilitary was responsible. English Premier League football clubs will vote today on whether to scrap the use of the video assistant referee or VAR. The FIS system has faced mounting scrutiny recently following notable errors. Tourism officials in China's Henan province have been forced to acknowledge that the country's proclaimed highest uninterrupted waterfall got a helping hand from water pipes built into the rock face. The discovery of its secret was made by a hiker who posted a video on Chinese social media. It unleashed a torrent of criticism. That's the latest world news from the BBC.
Moira, thank you very much for the news summary. Hello there and welcome to Newsday with James and Vic. Shortly we'll be hearing about Sudanese people who are going hungry as famine looms because of the ongoing conflict between the Sudanese army and the rebels. Also bring you the latest in another conflict in Gaza. We'll look at the upcoming elections across Europe and we have a longer version of the Sport Bulletin and a hopeful presidential candidate in the upcoming Rwanda elections. Do stay with us if you can.
There is plenty of bad news out of Sudan right now. We've been telling you on the programme about the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, who've been accused of a massacre in the central Jazeera state. As many as 150 people could have died. The RSF have been fighting against the Sudanese military for more than a year now, and this civil war has resulted in around 18 million people suffering from acute hunger, according to aid groups. A fully-fledged famine is likely to be just around the corner, something we've been focusing on all week here on Newsday. Many people survive only because of the efforts of local groups. Groups like the Khartoum Aid Kitchen, a non-profit organisation helping to feed families in need in Khartoum State, in and around the Sudanese capital. Listen here as volunteers prepare rice in large steaming pots, as local people wait for their daily ration of rice and lentils. The Khartoum Aid Kitchen was co-founded by Mohamed Al Bilal, a Sudanese British national. When we spoke in the British city of Manchester, he began by telling me about a man so hungry he ended up in a wheelchair.
The situation of those trapped in Khartoum is a situation of famine, basically. So we find some terrible cases, and one of those cases is that of Sadiq. And Sadiq, he hasn't had a proper meal for over a month. And what it appears that's been happening is that any food that's been arriving, he's basically been prioritizing for his children. So I shared a picture of him, and he's in a wheelchair, but he's not disabled. He's just so malnutritioned that he's lost the ability to walk. So once we found him, we've dedicated a plan to try and get him to recover. And we are gradually seeing some improvements.
Have you tragically seen examples of people who have died of hunger already?
Yeah, I mean, I speak to my kitchen managers and they tell me the stories they hear. And there's this old man who comes to one of the kitchens, and he was trapped in a part of Old Omdurman, which was basically cut off from food supplies. And his wife died of starvation, basically. So real people are dying of starvation.
We've heard throughout the week how expensive food and all sorts of basic goods have become. Is it costly, difficult to get the things you need to feed so many people?
From our point of view, as a Westerner, it's not expensive at all. Because we can buy in bulk, we can negotiate a good price. So we pay something like the equivalent of £14 for a 25-kilogram sack of rice.
$17, $18 maybe, something like that.
Yep. And we can support off that bag something like 200, 250 people easily. So it's not a lot of money by Western standards, but our issue is funding. There's no issue getting supplies into most of Khartoum State. And even when there's areas where there is difficulties, because our volunteers are from the community themselves, they're willing to go to places where a humanitarian organization wouldn't be willing to go to. So, for example, there is a kitchen which for security reasons I can't specify exactly where, but the only way we are able to supply is by boat. Now, it's a treacherous trip, and they will load it onto the boats, and then they will put it onto a donkey cart, and they will deliver it. And the reason they will take these risks is because they have families in these communities who are hungry, who are at risk of starvation. So because we are utilizing people from the community itself, we are able to get to places where most international aid agencies wouldn't be able to get to.
If I went to one of your food kitchens today, what would I see?
So in our larger kitchens, you would see a long queue of people. You would hear lots of pots banging, and it's quite a loud affair. So it's well-natured. There has to be some queue management. So we have a lot of people, a group of volunteers just there to organize the lines for the kitchen. But you will see lots of pots. You will see lines of people queuing to get their food.
As a Sudanese, How do you manage to keep your spirits up, seeing what you see every day, the stories you hear every day? How do you manage to keep going, really?
There's no other choice. I mean, I'm privileged to be in a position where I'm able to help. And I know that if I bury my head for the sake of my mental health, the effect of that would be people dying, people that I may have met, people in the local community. And, you know, when this war ends, I don't want to come and find more people that have died than have already died. So I think if you're in a position where you can help, given the disastrous nature of what's happening, where 2.5 million people can die just like that. And it's hard for people to comprehend that sort of figure. So this is why we show individual cases, to try and, you know, show that these are people with their own lives and aspirations, and you know, we want them to survive. And it really does not cost much for us to save them.
Mohamed El Bilal there from Khartoum Aid Kitchen. They and other similar organizations have GoFundMe pages and rely on donations from the Sudanese diaspora. We've had so many messages in on this. I'll just read a couple. Alfred in the US says, who are these two heartless generals and what are they fighting for? The suffering of the people of Sudan is beyond imaginable. And Alex Okumu in Kampala, Uganda, says there's a need for top world religious leaders to reconcile the generals. They should be made to feel pity for the suffering of innocent civilians.
Well, let's return to another conflict and a story that we've been covering all throughout March of this year here on the program, the conflict in Gaza. More than 20 people have been killed and dozens injured in an Israeli strike on a United Nations school housing displaced people in Al-Nusayriyat in the central Gaza Strip. The Israeli military confirmed this on Twitter, or X now as we call it, that it had targeted the school, saying it had been home to Hamas terrorists who had taken part in the October 7th attacks. Ambulances and rescue teams have been seen rushing the wounded and the dead to a nearby hospital. Well, let's bring in our correspondent from Jerusalem, Yolande Nell. Good morning to you, Yolande, and welcome back to the program. Has there been any new updates since this airstrike happened?
Well, we've been hearing from the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in nearby Deir al-Balah that it has seen at least 40 people who have been killed. It's not clear if they are just from the school. We know that six people were killed in another strike on a home as well as that. But certainly there had been dozens of people who were wounded as well as those killed in the strike on this school, a UN school in the Nusayriyat urban refugee camp in central Gaza. Now, the Israeli military says that it was targeting there what it calls terrorists from Hamas and Islamic Jihad, saying that they belong to the Nukba elite forces, were operating in the compound, and that they had been involved in those deadly 7th of October attacks on Israel. On social media, you can see in videos that we can't independently verify, but there are bodies lined up in body bags under blankets, and you can see that there are small corpses among the dead, with witnesses saying that several children were among those killed, that there had been hundreds of displaced people sheltering in what was previously working as a UN school but had turned into a shelter during the war, and that the head of the Hamas-run government media office in Gaza rejecting Israeli claims the school had hidden a Hamas command post. The Israeli military says that before this strike, it took a number of steps to minimize harm to civilians, saying these included aerial surveillance and getting additional intelligence.
So, Yolande, does this latest strike jeopardize the current ceasefire talks?
Yeah, and Israel said that there would be no halt to fighting during the ceasefire talks. And, of course, that does really feed into the difficulties, the challenges of these talks. The latest we're hearing through the media, really, is that Hamas is asking for clarifications on the differences that it sees between proposals for a three-phase ceasefire laid out by President Biden last week and by Israel. President Biden had presented his plan as being being an Israeli one, but sources in Hamas have really been expressing pessimism regarding the possibility of a new deal. They say that Israel objects to the proposal that has been laid out by the Americans. And, you know, there is a memo on these negotiations going on sent to the different Palestinian factions that's circulating, and it says that the current Israeli proposal deviates from the one presented by President Biden. Basically, that's being interpreted as saying that, you know, Israel's only willing to implement the first stage of this proposal, which would bring many of its hostages home from Gaza, while keeping the option of renewing the fighting in Gaza afterwards. And of course, what Hamas is insisting on is that there should be a full end to the war in Gaza and a full withdrawal of Israeli troops.
All right, Yolande, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Yolande Nell.
Voting for the European elections starts today and ends on Sunday across the European Union's 27 member states. People will vote for national representatives who will then join larger coalitions in the European Parliament, where 720 MPs sit. Polls suggest that the biggest blocs, centre-right and centre-left, will remain relatively stable. The big change is expected to be an increase of populist right-wing politicians. Now, the Netherlands and Estonia vote today. We are going to concentrate on the Netherlands and speak to Louise van Schaik, from the Klingendaal Institute in The Hague, a political think tank. Welcome to the programme, Louise. What have been the big issues, do you think, for Dutch voters?
Yeah, for the Dutch voters, first of all, the migration issue is on top of mind. And also, this will be a vote of confidence for the incoming government in which Gilders, a radical right-wing party, takes place.
Yeah, so they're just putting that coalition together after elections 6 months or so ago. It's interesting then to see European issues reflecting domestic ones very much, you seem to be saying.
Yeah, there wasn't really a big election campaign. It wasn't very visible. People don't really know the people that they can vote for these European elections, so the members of European Parliament nominees. So we saw that Wilders himself came out and said, please don't vote for Labour, the combined Labour-Greens party, which is polling against him on similar levels. He tried to make it really a national election. What will be really interesting to watch today will be whether his voters are actually going to the poll to vote, because in the past we've seen a relatively low turnout in our country, and we have to see if the Dutch today will really go and cast their vote.
Who would a low turnout benefit, do you think?
Well, usually in the Netherlands, the conservative right-wing parties and radical right-wing parties don't profit if the turnout is low. But also this we have to see, because we see in other European countries that radical right-wing voters are seem to be more keen to vote this time around because they're, you know, so frustrated and angry about issues. But for the Netherlands, we still have to see if they will show up today.
Is there a sense then that the radical right, not just in the Netherlands but elsewhere, also feels energized, on the verge of success in many places?
Yeah, that's also a big question. And this is also a reason why I guess many other radical right-wing parties will look to what happens today in the Netherlands. In the evening, this evening at 9 o'clock European time, we will have an exit poll. So the Netherlands is not allowed to already announce the real results of the elections, but there will be an exit poll. And I'm sure that many others in Europe will look at this exit poll.
Yeah, interesting that, I suppose, an election happening over several days. What's the case then that the sort of two major sides, as it were, have been making to voters?
So I guess it's a story about, you know, to what extent do you want to cooperate within the European Union? So the radical right-wing parties don't want to leave, no Nexit as it's called. They don't want to leave anymore the EU, but they want to change it from within, meaning, you know, taking back control to the national state Whereas, you know, the Labour Party and Greens and the Liberal Party say, well, we need now more Europe. We need common European defence policies, defence industrial base build up in Europe. We also, for migration, we need common policies because we have a common border. So there's really this difference about, do you cooperate with European parties or do you take the Netherlands as centre stage?
Louise van Schaik from the Klingendaal Institute in The Hague. Thank you very much indeed. Now, I think we should get some sports news with Isaac Fallon.
Yeah, later on Thursday, the NBA basketball finals begin as the Boston Celtics take on the Dallas Mavericks in Game 1. The Mavs come into the finals as heavy underdogs against the Celtics, who have had the best record in the regular season, 68 wins and just 18 losses. In the playoffs, they've been equally dominant, losing just twice. I spoke to Noah Dalzell, who is the Celtics beat writer for SB Nation, and I asked her whether it's been too easy for the Celtics having breezed through the playoffs.
First of all, I wouldn't say that they necessarily breezed through the playoffs, just because this most recent round, like, 3 out of the 4 games came down to the last couple possessions. And so they very well could have, you know, that could have been a 7-game series had they not, you know, kind of closed things out in crunch time. But yeah, they haven't had the most rigorous path to the finals. They're certainly not anything that compares to their last couple of playoff runs where they were kind of playing all the best teams that felt like every single round. I have Celtics in 6 in the finals, and I think that's regardless of whether or not we see Kristaps Porzingis back at full strength. I think they just have, they have more continuity with their team. They have players that really excel their role across all 5 spots, and they've been a historically good basketball team, as you said. So, yeah, that's my prediction. I you know, respect Dallas a lot. I think they could put up a hell of a fight, but I would be surprised if the Celtics can close this out.
Now, people might be surprised that the Mavs have made it this far, even though they've arguably got the best player in the world at the moment, Luka Doncic. There are other teams, perhaps in the West, who may have been seen as stronger, the reigning champions, the Nuggets, the Minnesota Timberwolves, who the Mavs just beat. Earlier on this season, the Celtics beat them both times they've played this season, but the Mavs certainly seem like a different team now, don't they?
Yeah, they're definitely a different team than the Celtics, than the one the Celtics have faced earlier in the season. The way that they approached the trade deadline and the players that they picked up, PJ Washington, Daniel Gafford, I mean, they totally changed the game for this team. I would say I wasn't expecting them to come out of the West. I was pretty sure Denver was going to come out of the West, and if not, Minnesota was going to knock them off in the conference finals. And Minnesota did knock them off, but I think they didn't have enough to beat Dallas, and that actually made sense when you look at their, you know, unique rosters. But yeah, certainly it kind of gave this impression that Dallas wasn't going to be here. But now that they're here, their roster makes a whole lot of sense, right? I think you would have looked at a lot of teams and I could see them being here. I think if Phoenix had pulled it together, all of a sudden you're looking at Devin Booker and Kevin Durant and, you know, you're saying, okay, how do you stop this team? Like, there's a lot of talent in the NBA. There's a lot of teams that would be very formidable. And based on how things shook out this year, Dallas got here. And now you have to think about, how do you stop this backcourt and how do you kind of neutralize the role players? Because you can't have Derek Lively having 6 alley-oop dunks uncontested a game. Like, you just can't have that, right? And you can't have Luka getting easy ones, but Luka's going to score 30 regardless. That's, you know, that's not going to change. So to me, with this Dallas team, you have to figure out, like, what can you live with and what can you not? And Joe Mazzulla has talked about that this entire break, that you're going to have to live with certain things. The question is, what can you live with? And then executing and making sure that's what you're getting. I think that's going to be the case with Dallas as well, that there are certain things they're going to have to live with. And it's just a question of, you know, can you do enough on the other end to make up for that?
Let's talk about large scale then, Noah. The Celtics are the joint most successful team in NBA history alongside their great rivals, the LA Lakers. They've both won 17 titles each. If they win this time, it will be 18 titles and bragging rights. What will this title mean to people in Boston?
Oh, I think the city is, it needs this title. And I know that I talk to people, reporters, fans from other cities all the time, and they're always like, Boston doesn't need anything. You guys have so many championships, like, you guys are fine. But there's this anxiety and there's this frustration around this particular Celtics era because they've been in the conference finals, feels like every year, you know, it feels like they should have won already by now. And even though when you look at the ages of the core guys on this roster, like, really it was just the last couple of years that they were actually, in their prime. And I think last year was the first year that they underachieved. You know, 2022, I don't think anybody thought they were going to win the championship that year. And so to me, it's more about like how much anxiety there is around this group that I almost feel like people aren't really enjoying the greatness of this team and how great they were all year, because the whole time they were like, they're not going to win the championship. They never win. This group can't do it. And so I just want them to win so the next year we can actually enjoy watching basketball again, because I feel like people really slept on how dominant of a basketball team this was. I mean, this was historically like the point differentials, the record. They never lost more than two in a row. Like there was really not much to complain about. And so I think there will just be this collective like sigh of relief if they can get it done. And I think the basketball world here will be a lot better moving forward. And hopefully next year we can actually like live in the moment a little bit more.
Noah Dalzell there from SB Nation. It's going to be a fantastic series between the Boston Celtics and the Dallas Mavericks.
Thank you, Isaac. Now we turn to Rwanda, where one of the country's leading activists and a critic of longtime President Paul Kagame now says she wants to run for president in the country's elections scheduled for July the 15th. Diane Rwigara had previously tried to run for the presidency but was barred from standing and then imprisoned for tax evasion and inciting insurrection, charges she said were politically motivated and on which she was eventually cleared. So why this second attempt in a country where political dissidents often say they are punished severely? I've been speaking to her from the capital, Kigali.
If I am allowed to campaign to run, and if Rwandans are allowed to choose freely, I do believe I can win this election. The main problem in Rwanda is many people live in fear. We'll see what happens. I hope that I'll be allowed to campaign.
Soon after announcing that you are planning to stand, you said that one of your main focus and aims were, if you are elected, to make sure the Rwandans were able to feed themselves, to have their homes, and for their children to go to school. Already, children are going to school for free in Rwanda. Already, there is a part of the universal health care. I just wonder, what do you plan, or how do you plan to go on achieving more for your people than is already achieved at the moment?
What's on paper and what's happening on the ground are sometimes different. Yes, Rwanda is portrayed as a country where the economy has been growing, but on the ground, it's different. People do lack the basics of life, food, water, shelter. People are not allowed to work freely. The state is constantly interfering, especially with private businesses. It's easier for foreigners, for example, to come and do business in Rwanda than it is for Rwandans. Of course, it's good to have foreign investment. It's needed. But we should also be allowed as Rwandans to participate in the development of our country. Because right now, the state is the biggest employer in Rwanda. There's no room for the private sector to develop.
Well, somebody listening, knowing your background, knowing the Rwandan politics and the landscape, might say, but Diane, your father was one of the richest men in the country. He was a private businessman and his business was thriving.
At what cost, though? At what cost? People do not know what was going on behind closed doors. And it's not just my father, but as long as you're not in partnership with the state, with the party in power, then it becomes very difficult for you to develop economically.
Winning the election is quite a tall order. I wonder then, Diane, what will you bring to the table for millions of Rwandans to say we choose her instead of the incumbent President Kagame?
What I'm bringing to the table is change. Change in economics, socially, politically. I think for people to be able to thrive, they should be allowed to be. What I mean by that is they should be allowed to speak freely. Whatever they want to do in life, they should be allowed to do so without feeling the need first to ally themselves with the party in power.
You've talked about lack of freedoms in the country, and you know this is something that the Rwandan government has denied many years. Some might also be saying, but you running could be a sign of those changes, no?
I'm not allowed to run yet.
You even being able to get the 960 plus, you know, signatures, which in 2017 you were actually jailed because they said you had fabricated the signatures.
In 2017, I had double the number. They require 600 signatures. I had over 1,200, over 1,300 actually. So I did have enough signatures, but they had to find a reason to stop me from running. And they say that I had false signatures. Being able to collect signatures and being allowed to run are two different things. I had fulfilled all the requirements in 2017, yet I was not able to run. So I'm hoping that this time I'll be able to run.
Diane Guigara, the Rwandan politician and activist, on her hopes to see her name on the ballot in the upcoming elections in Rwanda next month. Later today, she and others will be finding out if they made the list of those provincial candidates. This is News Day here on the BBC service. We've enjoyed your company.